This weekend starts right after this.
As a business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News, This Weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Members of the jury who fall asleep, I'm Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
Are lawyers boring, or do people serving on a jury have short attention spans? Hear how courts deal with jurors who can't stay awake.
America's youngest generation is in the midst of a mental health crisis. Find out the leading cause.
Why researchers say holiday music can be bad for your mental health.
And how to avoid overspending while you're killing time at the airport.
Well, the average person, when they're waiting at the airport, spends $141 on drinks and food and all this other crap that you're sitting there waiting at the airport. So I just thought, you know, how do you save money at the airport beyond, of course, bringing your own snacks and bringing your own empty water bottle? Everybody knows to do that. But how do you save beyond just those things?
Katie Hill at Moneyish.com on savvy hacks to keep money in your wallet during an airport delay. That story later in the hour. The massive response by the New York City Police Department to the most recent terror attack exposed the limits of the anti-terrorism force the city has built since the deadly attacks of 9/11. It has learned to respond quickly and effectively, but faces an almost impossible task in trying to thwart every threat, especially the acts of lone wolves targeting public spaces and New York's large transit system. More now from Joseph Axe, reporter at Reuters. Joseph, what did you look at?
So if you looked at what happened in New York, you know, the immediate response was pretty overwhelming. And, you know, very quickly, you had the suspect in custody. You had the people who were injured on their way to hospitals. You had hundreds of police officers everywhere. Streets were shut down. The subway system had been rerouted. You know, all those things happened incredibly quickly, which kind of shows how, on some level, how impressive the counterterrorism response is in New York. But it also, you know, the fact that this guy was able to, you know, walk into one of the most crowded transit hubs in the city with a bomb strapped to his chest and then try to set it off also kind of shows that there's a limit to how much they can do in terms of prevention. And so the response was really good. And I'm not saying that they should be blamed necessarily, but the point is that when you've got a huge city like New York and you've got a subway system that's so sprawling and obviously for obvious reasons is so open to the public, it's simply impossible to fully prevent these type of attempted attacks.
Yeah, I mean, what could you do? We screen every passenger that starts to walk down the stairs of a New York City subway station? That it just doesn't seem like that's a logistical possibility.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, for one thing, the subway system, at least here in New York, carries almost 6 million passengers every day. But beyond that, you know, just generally, transit systems by their nature are kind of inherently open. Otherwise, they don't work. So they're not like airports where you actually can screen every passenger.
Yeah.
And even at airports, as we've seen in Europe, you know, you run the danger of the parts of the airport that are, in fact, accessible to the public. There's no real solution there either. And so I think, you know, a lot of security experts will kind of say, and when I was talking to them yesterday, they were making the point, you know, again, there's a limit to how much prevention you can actually do, you know, short of essentially giving up on the idea of having an open society.
Right. So what's the answer to this? Or what's the answer that, security officials want us to hear?
Yeah, so you know, there isn't really a great kind of silver bullet, right? So to the extent that any police department can address this stuff, New York has done so, right? So they've got extensive camera networks throughout the subway system and indeed throughout the entire city. They've got radiation detectors to search for, you know, dirty bombs. They've got undercover officers. They've got bomb sniffing dogs. I mean, so they've got about as many layers as they can possibly come up with. And then, of course, you've got what the mayor did, which was, you know, to remind people what's now kind of become a cliche. But if you see something, say something, right? That, you know, especially in something like the transit system, you really do have millions of people going about their business every day, and the police really do rely on them to alert officers if they see something out of the ordinary.
We're speaking with Joseph Axe, reporter at Reuters. He's written a piece entitled New York Subway Attack Shows Limits of Counter-Terror Strategy. You mentioned crowds, like in the subway, but this time of year, I've always said in New York, from, say, the start of the New York City Marathon right through Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, there are all kinds of crowds who stand outside and, you know, look at, you know, do window shopping at some of the popular stores, or, you know, or Rockefeller Center looking at the Christmas tree, or huddled in Times Square. I mean, so many soft targets of large groups, it seems.
Yeah, you're absolutely right about that. And, you know, we saw, you know, right here in New York about 6 weeks ago, we saw, you know, that truck attack where he basically just drove onto a bike path. And, you know, imagine if someone did a similar thing, you know, in, as you said, at near Rockefeller Center, where the Christmas tree is. I mean, where you've got throngs of people day and night from now until beyond Christmas. So, yeah, that's the stuff that keeps people up at night, I think. And, you know, the police department will tell you that they've, you know, they've got literally thousands of officers out there. And for big events like the Christmas tree lighting, or obviously the Times Square New Year's Eve celebration, you know, they've got an enormous number of police officers, including undercover officers, you know, going through those crowds and keeping an eye out for anything suspicious. Yeah. But again, you know, there are limits, right? I mean, if people are really determined to do this sort of thing, they're going to do it.
Thanks, Joseph. Joseph Axe, reporter at Reuters. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, America's teens facing a mental health crisis. Thanks for spending time with us. Today's teenagers are facing the greatest amounts of mental health issues. What makes them different from other generations? We're joined now by Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist and chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health. Doctor, explain new findings from the CDC.
Well, there's been a significant increase in suicidal attempts in our youngest from 3 to about 17 across the nation. In fact, the millennial generation actually has the highest suicide rate attempt than any previous generation, and I think this next group behind them is going to be even higher, because 13 to 17-year-olds are running at about 32% suicide attempt rate right now.
What's going on here?
Well, what we're seeing is this lack of connection. When we're so connected and everything is going through the electronics, there's sort of a connection malnutrition going on. It's kind of like drinking a diet soda. You get a sweet, satisfying taste, but there's no nutrition behind it. So when you have all these friends and everybody on Facebook, on Instagram, on Snapchat, and you know, you think everything's going good, but then you're sick and nobody comes around and brings you chicken soup. So there's that disconnect there that is kind of a false feeling for these kids. Then they're having a separation from their own family, because everybody in the family, they may be in the living room, but everybody's on a screen doing some kind of internet connectivity.
Wow. You put this squarely in the lap of social media?
Yes. I know that's harsh, but I think that's, I mean, there's other researchers out there that's showing that that's the only thing that has really changed that has caused all of this. And I think it's not only risk for mental health, I think there's some physical issues coming up, because this is a time, you know, through adolescence and young adulthood, where we get all this physical exertion out there and we do things like build up the density of our bones and things like that because of physical exertion. And then that lasts us till we're 60, 70, 80 years old and we start having osteoporosis and having our hips fail us and breaking, you know, hip bones and things like that. And some of the doctors I work with at the hospitals are now saying that, you know, these kids aren't going out there and doing it, and they could be having these medical problems in their late 30s, early 40s, through their 60s.
Wow.
So we may have a crippled society here very shortly.
Oh, my goodness. What are the signs, I guess, if you're a parent and you yourself can pick your nose up out of your phone, I guess, what should you be looking for?
Well, one of the things you look for, you know, it's normal for kids to be moody during adolescence and their childhood. You know, there's so much going on. They're learning how to socialize. But if you see this consistently every day for, say, more than 2 weeks, that is a big sign that you need to jump in there. Because even when kids are going through growth spurts and they're having hormonal changes, it's not every single day. They may have three bad days, then they'll have one or two good days, then they'll have a couple more bad days. You know, so if you're not seeing those good days over a period of two or more weeks, you need to step up to the plate and check out your kid and see what's going on.
Well, we're speaking with Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist, also chairman of a nonprofit called Mainstream Mental Health. Backpedal for just a minute here. We place the blame squarely on social media before. What about the electronic devices themselves, or is that kind of one and the same when we talk about this?
You know, and it may not be completely fair to blame it all on social media, even though that's what the research is showing, because if they have controlled or limited access to social media, it can actually be very, very beneficial, especially if kids are isolated or if they're, like, maybe sick and in the hospital. They can stay in touch with friends and family and stuff like that. And the research is saying anything more than 2 hours of the day starts ticking up your risk for depression. Mm. So if you're a parent, I would monitor that. And it doesn't really seem to matter whether it's on your cell phone or a tablet or on your computer. Now, we're not seeing that connection with television, and part of that is television's passive. You sit there, and if you get upset at somebody on the television, you can talk to the people in the room with you. If you're upset at somebody on Instagram, you send them an emoji or you unlike something, and you know, you're actually directly interfacing, and it feels like, at least initially, that you're having that connection that you would if they were sitting in the living room with you, but you're not, and it's lacking that nutrition.
And only about 3 million of those 15 million are getting treatment. Why is that?
Well, the stigma, you know, and plus they're not identifying things. You know, kids are having problems academically in school. Well, that can be a sign of depression. Kids are having, they have ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Those can be actually signs in adolescence and late teens of depression and anxiety. They can't focus. They can't attend. Their grades are dropping. Those are all red flags. You need to go get your kid checked out.
Thanks, John. Dr. John Huber, clinical forensic psychologist, also chairman of Mainstream Mental Health. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. TV cooking competitions starring boys and girls in chef coats have boomed over the past 4 years. The first generation to grow up watching cooking competitions on TVs is pushing this new wave of kitchen warriors. This year, children from third grade through high school could compete on at least 6 different cooking contests across 3 networks. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
If you've flipped through the cooking shows lately, you may have noticed that the chefs are getting younger and younger. In fact, chefs as young as 8 are getting into these TV contests. Here with more on this new entertainment trend is Ellen Gammerman of the Wall Street Journal. Ellen, when and how did this all get started?
It started about 4 years ago with MasterChef Junior. That's one of the ones that really brought it to the forefront. And since then, there have been many more shows, and they've gotten more and more competitive. So the pressure cooker situation for these kids is getting pretty intense.
What is it about kid chefs that is drawing audiences? I mean, do you think that the audiences are more drawn to the kids competing than the adults?
I think the adults, certain shows like Top Chef, have been very popular, and a new show, Top Chef Junior, is almost the same exact thing, but with kids. So on the one hand, you're watching children, but on the other, you're watching children cook like adults. But then they also cry, and they have very childlike moments as well. So it's kind of fascinating to see this adult version of children in the kitchen.
Ellen, can these kids really cook? Are they making stuff that we want to eat?
I think so. I talked with someone from Top Chef Junior, one of the judges, and she said that there was no spit bucket. Like, she could eat everything. And she thought that some of the food was better than what adults had cooked her. So these kids are reading the French Laundry cookbook. They grew up watching cooking shows. And in many cases, they've actually been on other cooking shows on TV. At least 3 of the 12 on Top Chef Junior were on Chopped Junior, and another one from that same show had been on MasterChef Junior.
I was going to ask you, Ellen, if these kids were getting help from outside sources, or are they really on the spot when they're in these contests and they have to come up with something?
I think they're on the spot. There is a time clock, and, you know, the very first episode of some of these shows can be brutal because the kids are realizing they don't get extra time. But at the same time, there are people on set, chefs, supervisors who will, let's say, do a tutorial on knife skills or give them some grounding in whatever skills might be necessary for a big challenge. So they're not left completely on their own.
Yeah, we're speaking with Ellen Gammerman of the Wall Street Journal. There was an actual comment on the story that you wrote in the journal, and somebody said, don't people know the kitchen is the most dangerous place? Why are kids in there? So no one's getting hurt, are they?
Well, if you look closely, you see lots of little Band-Aids, but they say that they haven't had to cart anybody off. If you speak to the executives from these shows, they'll tell you, it's minor, it burns or cuts, and everyone can compete. But their defense is that these children are the most watched children in the world. They're surrounded by a ring of medics. Parents are nearby, on set, guardians, teachers, culinary experts. So they really are pretty closely watched if they're about to get in a dangerous situation.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Ellen Gammerman. 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. The holidays are here. Why not wow friends and family with a new type of gift, a package from Omaha Steaks. My wife loves the filet mignons. I'm a fan of the sausages. My kids prefer the burgers. Those meats are just part of what's in the family gift pack. To get it, visit omahasteaks.com and enter my code Gordon in the search bar for 75% off. Here's what you get in the family gift pack for less than $50. 2 filet mignons, 2 top sirloins, 2 boneless pork chops, 4 boneless chicken breasts, 4 kielbasa sausages, 4 burgers, 4 potatoes au gratin, 4 caramel apple tartlets, and an Omaha Steaks seasoning packet. Plus, for free right now, 4 additional kielbasa sausages. Go to omahasteaks.com, enter my code Gordon in the search bar, and get a 75% savings. The gift is guaranteed to be a hit. Again, omahasteaks.com, enter my code Gordon in the search bar. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenko coming up this half hour. Hacks to keep you from overspending while you wait at the airport. Also, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you're snoring. And why holiday music is bad for your mental health. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Tolls that began recently along an interstate outside the nation's capital illustrate a choice that states and local governments increasingly offer to manage traffic congestion. Pay more during busy parts of the day for the privilege of driving faster. A couple of dozen jurisdictions nationwide have adopted tolls that fluctuate depending on traffic congestion. Virginia is the latest. Here's USA Today transportation reporter Bart Jansen. Bart, what do we have?
Yeah, we have a new highway toll just outside Washington, D.C., Interstate 66, which is one of the major roads that comes in just inside the Beltway. And among tolls in the area, the Virginia Department of Transportation decided to start letting motorists pay a toll to get into the HOV lane. So, in effect, it only applies to single motorists or motorists with only one person in the car trying to head in, you know, commuting in the morning or heading home in the afternoon during the peak hours, that if they're willing to pay more, that they can get into the HOV lanes that had been reserved for people with two or more in the car. Where it got interesting and sort of the new evolution in this kind of toll is that it can adjust, because they're collected electronically, they can adjust it minute by minute. The amount of the toll fluctuates every 6 minutes.
Wow.
During these peak periods, and so it gets more expensive as the road gets more crowded. You might have to pay $40.
Do you know that ahead of time?
Well, you can see the sign. There are signs posted along the road, and so they light up, and they change as the amount of congestion changes, and so you do see it before you get on. The problem is that in areas where you know, if traffic is totally stopped or you get down to just the HOV lanes, if you can't get on there at all, you know, you've sort of made your commitment to the road, and so it's difficult to get onto the side roads, the other highways leading into the city. So, yes, you do get posted about the price, but it might be difficult to make the change once you've sort of committed to that road.
Okay, so what does this sign indicate then, and could the sign change without you knowing it while you're on that strip of road?
No, they say you will get the price that is posted as you enter. Now, what they don't know yet, because this is still brand new, it only started on Monday, but they're going to be looking at the actual billing, which is done electronically through what we call EasyPass here in the D.C. area. That's an electronic way to pay tolls up and down the East Coast to see what people actually paid. They'll be sorting that out in the days ahead. But, yeah, the price does not change once you're on the corridor.
I was going to say, otherwise I might pull over and just wait for a cheaper rate, right? I'll just sit here with my hazards on for a couple of minutes.
or wait till the peak period to end. It's something like 5:30 to 9:30 in the mornings and 3 to 7 in the afternoons. One of the complaints in this road was that those hours, which had been just HOV hours, you know, you always had to have more people in the car to try to, you know, discourage congestion, encourage people to use mass transit. Mm-hmm. The hours have expanded slightly as they added the toll, and so people that used to try to get up a little bit earlier, now you have to get up a whole hour earlier to avoid the tolls, or to be able to use the HOV without the lanes without having to pay. So it's still sort of an experiment in motion here, but the Virginia Secretary of Transportation, Aubrey Lane, says that he thinks it started well, and they're excited to see, you know, how many people use it. In the first couple of days, it was about 10 or 12,000 cars using the toll. It's unclear. They need to figure out how much of those were actually paying, how many were just motorcycles, but it's an experiment they're interested to take a look at.
Interesting. We're speaking with Bart Jansen, USA Today transportation writer. He's written a piece entitled Dynamic Tolls, How Highways Can Charge $40 for Driving Just 10 Miles. It really comes down to, I guess, what's your time worth, right?
Exactly. Lane himself, who, you know, created these lanes to try to manage congestion. This isn't the way tolls have always been, is to pay for the new bridge or pay for the new lanes on the highway. In this case, this was a permission that Congress granted back in 1991 to say, you know what, you can start tinkering with just managing congestion and use tolls to basically, hey, you want to drive on the open lanes, you might have to pay a little extra. Yeah. And that extra will fluctuate depending on how many cars are on the road.
Thanks, Bart. That's Bart Jansen, USA Today transportation reporter. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. With extra travelers this holiday season and TSA implementing new measures, you won't be surprised if you encounter long lines at airports. But when that happens, we often spend money on everything from snacks to clothing to pass the time, denting what might be a thin vacation budget. How to save on airport spending from Katie Hill, editor at Moneyish.com. Katie, help us out.
Yeah, well, the average person, when they're waiting at the airport, spends $141 on drinks and food and all this other crap that you're sitting there waiting at the airport. So I just thought, you know, how do you save money at the airport beyond, of course, bringing your own snacks and bringing your own empty water bottle? Everybody knows to do that. But how do you save beyond just those things?
All right. What is some of the priciest stuff once you get to the airport or perhaps past security?
Yeah. So think about what they have, a captive market in there. So food and beverages, they know you're going to want to eat, drink. Those tend to be more expensive. Chocolates, candies, the local handicraft stuff, that tends to be way overpriced too. Interestingly, sometimes like luxury goods, you know, the airport kind of looks like a shopping mall now, and you'll see Coach and Gucci and Louis Vuitton. Sometimes those are actually fairly priced in the airport. So if you're in the market for that anyway, and you were going to buy that anyway, that might be something to look at. Also, alcohol, sometimes cosmetics and toiletries. Those can be decently priced in the airport. Again, you have a smartphone in your pocket. You might as well just check prices online, you know, right there. Look at your smartphone, make sure. But those tend to be, you know, are often decently priced. But, yeah, stay away. The food and drink is just going to be overpriced.
Mm. I thought it was interesting, too, that somebody said it might actually be worth buying one of those single-day passes at a lounge to kind of keep your wallet in your pocket mostly.
Yeah, I agree with this, actually, too. Okay, so they usually charge about $50. You get all-day access to the lounge. Let's say your flight's seriously delayed, The thing with the lounge is you often get free coffee, free tea. You get free, you know, magazines and newspapers to read, a Wi-Fi in there, a place to sit. So if you were going to have to go buy a big meal and you were going to go buy yourself coffee and a bunch of magazines, you might actually end up on top by going in the lounge and doing all that and accessing that for free. Plus, just for the sanity's sake, those lounges, you might get a seat, there's more room. So combine all that together and that could be worth buying as well.
We're speaking with Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. Her piece is called Four Savvy Hacks to Keep You from Overspending at the Airport. How about these various free options?
Right. So airports, they know you, that you're stuck there. There's sometimes free stuff, free art exhibits, museum exhibits, kids' play areas. Like, you know, there's a walking trail in the Dallas-Fort Worth Airport. There's a cool garden at O'Hare. Live music in Nashville. You can research this ahead of time. So if you just have this feeling that you're going to be one of those people stuck there waiting for hours and hours and hours, especially if you have kids you need to entertain, Google ahead of time and see what might be in your airport that they offer for free. Those big airports generally do have something.
Last hack, don't forget to add this to your packing list, you said, which is what?
Your chargers for your phone and your laptop and your Kindle. Because, you know, okay, people say, I know to bring snacks, I bring a water bottle. I mean, we often forget our chargers, and they are so overpriced in the airport. They have those kiosks, and they charge you a ton to get a new charger for your phone because they know you're desperate and you need one. So just make sure to put that on the packing list. That's one of the ways the airport really gets you to spend too much.
Thanks, Katie. Katie Hill, editor at moneyish.com. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Small business never stops moving, so Dell's U.S.-based small business technology advisors are trained to keep up. Just call 877-BUY-DELL to get connected with an advisor who will get to know your business and tailor a solution with Dell PCs powered by Intel Core processors that is right for you, so you can focus on your business and leave the tech questions to Dell. Call 877-BUY-DELL to get in touch with a tech advisor today. You don't often find the words business and friendly in the same sentence, let alone the same state. Unless, of course, you're talking about Michigan. Michigan's business-friendly practices help them become a leader in industries that range from agriculture and cybersecurity to aerospace and defense. In fact, Michigan is ranked among the top 10 states for major new and expanded facilities, which makes Michigan more than business-friendly. It makes Michigan business smart. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Thanks for joining us. The right to a jury trial is a pillar of America's justice system, right? Enshrined in the Constitution from a tradition dating back more than 1,000 years. The problem these days is making sure that jurors stay awake. It's a story from Wall Street Journal reporter Nicole Hong, who's covered cases recently and spotted sleeping jurors. Nicole, what have you witnessed?
So this started when I was following two big trials in New York in federal court. And in the same week, judges in both of those trials had dismissed jurors for sleeping. And one of the trials, I actually saw the jurors sleeping through most of the testimony. And I just found this sort of amusing, and I thought I would look into this a little bit deeper. And as I was talking to lawyers and former judges, a lot of them were saying this is a very common problem that everyone has to deal with in the courtroom.
I can understand that, I guess, to a certain extent, because some of the presentations, one, I guess, are boring, and two, the material can be so complicated, right? It just could go right over your head and just easily lose concentration.
Yeah, totally. Like the one I was covering, it's about U.S. sanctions against Iran, and it's really focused on, you know, bank records and spreadsheets, and the jurors are sitting there on these chairs for like hours at a time. They're not allowed to walk around, and especially if it's after lunch, it's kind of like sitting in a college lecture. I mean, we've probably all fallen asleep during a lecture school, so it's like that, but it's every single day for weeks at a time, especially for these really complicated federal trials.
Yeah, because as you say, it's a tricky balance. You run, I guess, some sort of risk if you're a lawyer who, like, barks at a juror to wake up, right? Then you could turn the juror against you, I guess.
Totally, and the lawyers I talked to said there are sort of sensitive, delicate ways you can bring it up with the judge at a sidebar, or, you know, kind of tell people about it private and have the judge deal with it so that the juror doesn't get pissed off at either side. But it is funny for audience members watching the trial, if there's someone just blatantly sleeping for days at a time, then you really have to do something about it.
Oh, goodness. So when you get dismissed, can you get in trouble, or could you get in trouble from the judge, I guess, during the trial?
You don't really get in trouble. I mean, the ones I've seen, the judge, a lot of times they're empathetic about it. They'll say maybe you night shift at your job, or maybe there's something going on in your personal life that is not allowing you to get sleep, so we're just going to dismiss you, thank you for your service, that kind of thing.
So how much of this perhaps falls on the way lawyers present material? Maybe they're not the best presenters, they're boring.
Well, I think also part of the issue is just the way trials play out in real life. It's completely not the way it's portrayed in like Law and Order or these movies. You have to, every single thing that's admitted into evidence has to enter the record somehow. So these witnesses will be up there, and it's just like a very laborious back and forth of like, is this the gun? Yes. Is this the blood on the shirt? Yes. So it's very meticulous, and it has to be that way. It's just required by law.
Thanks, Nicole. Wall Street Journal reporter Nicole Hong. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. At first, holiday music may spark nostalgia, get you in the holiday spirit, but researchers say hearing jingle bells for the millionth time can lead to annoyance, boredom, even distress. That's because the brain becomes oversaturated, triggering a negative response. If you're already, for example, worried about money, work, or seeing family during the holidays, the constant inundation of cheerful tunes may reinforce your stress instead of relieving it. Story on businessinsider.com. It can also be downright distracting, affecting employee productivity and irritating consumers. How can you strike the right balance of good cheer that doesn't drive you crazy? Switch up your music, for one, so people's brains don't get bored. Playing the same Christmas songs all season long produces cognitive fatigue. Practice good sound management by varying your playlists and keeping the volume in check. Studies show that wintry scents, too, like pine and cinnamon, help conjure happy emotions. So recruit other senses when celebrating. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.